Hey, good morning, Diane.
Oh, good morning, Chris. Good morning, Miriam. So thank you. Good morning, everybody else out there and TGIDF. And we took a little break last Friday. It was April Fool's Day, so we didn't want to play a joke on anybody. So we're here today. And we're going to talk about everybody's favorite topic, which is income that we use for alimony. And we have a guest speaker today, don't we, Chris?
Yes, we do. So this is Miriam Kozowski. And welcome, Miriam. And so Miriam is an attorney and a mediator and has been mediating full time for the last 10 years. And she's also a vice president of the Massachusetts Council on Family Mediation. And her website is mediationsaves.com.
And it's also, it's really, the full name is Mediation Saves Time, Money, Relationships, and Children.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense, but I guess it's too much to put into a website URL, right? Absolutely. But I think it's absolutely true. So Diane and I are fans of alternative dispute resolutions and mediation in particular. And so we're 100% on the page that mediation saves time and money and everything else.
Everything else. I am totally a true believer in mediation.
Okay. So today we're
definitely lowers the stress for everybody.
Okay. So today we get to talk about income. Is everyone's favorite topic. So in the past several episodes, we had talked about determining alimony, and we had talked about the concept of alimony being dependent on the need of the recipient and the ability to pay or the payor, and we've talked about various issues that come with that, right? So one of the things that the Alimony Reform Act provides is actually a formula, and that often is where we end up going first, right? Even though we should talk about needs first, right, and abilities to pay. But the formula was determined as 30 to 35% of the difference in income. And we're not going to talk about the tax aspect of it today because it was done before the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which we have somewhat addressed in the couple past episodes, right? So what we're going to talk about is that concept of the difference between the two incomes. A formula is great, 30 to 35%, but how do we determine income?
And what people just, so it isn't 30 to 35% anymore. It's lower because of the tax consequences, but yeah. So sometimes it could be very difficult because somebody might have a very big bonus at the end of the year. So the question is, what do you do as far as that is concerned? Do you include that at the outset or do you not? Because what happens if that person doesn't receive the income anymore? So typically what we do is we do an if, as, and when. So basically when somebody receives an income, then we look and we typically will have, and you could tell me, Chris and Diane, if you do the same thing, often what I'll do is the same percentage that we have for the base pay we'll then have as the bonus pay also. So if, as and when somebody receives a bonus within 7 days or whatever time period the clients want, then they will pay a certain percentage of that gross to the other person, along with showing the information, the documentation showing what the bonus was, just so that there's full disclosure, so everybody is on the same page.
Right. Well, I think one of the biggest things that people, the payor of alimony has, one of their problems is they're always going to say, oh, well, that bonus isn't guaranteed. Those commissions aren't guaranteed. And that's why we parse it out and we do what's called, we call different tiers, you know, different levels of alimony, tier one being just calculated on the base income, tier two on maybe variable income. But, you know, going back to the gross, the difference of the party's gross income. So that's what we want people also to understand is that we're using gross income. So when you look at a W-2 line one, that's not necessarily someone's gross income. And so it's really important to understand that, you know, a W-2 that line one is not the person's gross income. We have to maybe look at Medicare, but even that might not be the gross income. So we really have to look at the pay stub in order to determine someone's gross income. And so that's, a lot of people say, well, I contribute to my 401k and that's that, you know, I don't have that money. It's like, yep. But according to our guidelines in Massachusetts, we use gross income.
And it also, Diane, it also means if a company is going to match your contributions in any amount, that is also income that the person is receiving. So the employer match also should be included as income.
Right. Yeah, although that is not used very often, is it, Miriam?
I
agree with you. I think it should. Because it is income, it is something that the
person. It is income. So I think that it used to not be, but more and more people I know are using it because it is. It could be a significant amount that a person is receiving.
So that really leads us into the area of benefits. So an employee will receive a salary income usually, but there will also be benefits, right? And the match of the 401k is a benefit. Are there other benefits that considered income or should be?
Occasionally, an employer will pay for somebody's housing. And in that case, that would be a benefit. Typically, what's not included are benefits such as the employer payment of its share of, we'll say, Social Security taxes or its share of the medical insurance premium. That's typically not considered a benefit. That would be considered as income, but definitely if there are other perks, such as I know somebody who was receiving $5,000 a month towards payment of expenses for housing. So that definitely would be considered income because that would be money that otherwise would have to be spent by that person.
So oftentimes, in the example of a clergy, they will get a housing subsidy, but the housing subsidy is to some extent because they're living wherever they're living for the convenience of the employer, which means the religious community that they service, right? So to the extent that it is that they're doing that for not entirely for their own benefit, isn't some of that housing not income?
Well, that's an excellent case. And that's an excellent plug for mediation in a sense, because that's one of those great cases where there isn't a direct yes or no answer. And so it would really be a discussion with the couple to determine what they think is fair. In a case where it's a corporate housing and it's just as an added benefit, then that typically would be something that would be taxed, that would be included as alimony. But in a case like that, Chris, that would be a discussion. And I think that would be something that would be decided upon. So maybe none would be included, maybe a little bit.
Right. So sometimes what I see is that, for instance, in the clergy example, the subsidy for housing is actually not taxable income, right? And whereas in the corporate situation, when the corporation pays for housing, it is usually a taxable benefit, but not always. You know, it's a pain in the neck to figure these things out.
But you actually, Chris, made a great point that, you know, when people have, we'll say, self-employed, when they have their own businesses, there are certain times that they could deduct certain expenses such as business use of their home. But when it comes to looking at alimony, that does not get deducted because that's sort of like a tax benefit, but it's not really something that they should.
So all three of us work
from income, same thing as a lot of times depreciation.
I'm sorry, we had a little bit of interference there, but so we all three of us work from home, I think, mm-hmm. Right? And I think we legitimately deduct our home office expense right? Because it falls within the guidelines of the IRS. It's a dedicated space. That's all we do. It's enclosed and everything else, right? But, and so to some extent, I think that it is an expense. It actually is a legitimate expense, right? But we don't use that for divorce.
Yeah, it's a benefit. It's a way to reduce your taxable income. You're actually not paying. It's not an expense that you're putting out money towards from your income, and that's why, you know, just like depreciation on a home, it's not that you're not actually paying somebody that amount of depreciation. Oh. So this is the IRS. What we're able to do is within the IRS, we are code. We are allowed to use certain deductions to reduce our taxable income, you know, because we're self-employed. But in divorce, we don't have to use those. We are able to add them back in.
So something that's related is when employees get car benefit from their employer, that often happens for salespeople, for instance, right? So if a salesperson is going to drive all day long and every day on behalf of their employers, they will often have either a subsidy or a company-owned car of some kind. And they will use it to they will use it on the weekend for their own personal purposes. It seems to me that this is sort of incidentally income. Right? Yeah. Is that fair to say?
I typically don't include something like that. Sure. What about the two of you? Do you typically include a car benefit?
Not usually. It just depends, because sometimes what happens is you'll see it come in on the paycheck and then you'll see it go out. And yeah. Some, maybe not so much in a car, but maybe in some other kind of reimbursement type payment. So even though it's coming in from the employer, it's also going right back out on the employee side. So it's a wash.
Happens with life insurance.
Yeah. Right. Life insurance, group term disability, those types of things. I mean, again, you have to look at the pay stub. You have to really look, you know, analyze it, look at the W-2, the year-ending pay stub, because that's what I do. I look at those documents because that's how we're going to determine the income that's fair.
Right. But I think that to get to the point there is that about the car is that it really does depend. So if it is a business that is owned by one of the parties, and they will have a lot more flexibilities about what they deduct and don't deduct. And sometimes the flexibility is sort of stretched a little bit. But in those cases, it seems that it is possible that the car is actually income.
Hmm. So for example, expenses to send a child to college who does not necessarily need a college degree for their employment would not necessarily be considered an expense for alimony purposes.
Totally.
That is definitely not considered an expense. Yeah, well, we're going to be talking about self-employment income. And I think this right now, I think we're just focusing on W-2 and salaried employees, sure. Right? But yeah, the self-employed individual, that's a whole nother topic and a whole nother episode of Divorce Friday, which I think is next Friday.
So Diane, I wanted to touch on that thing that you mentioned earlier about using the same percentage for different tiers of income.
Oh, Miriam said that, but...
Miriam said that? Oh, okay. But it, what I've seen is that... that there are different tiers that are used for percentages for different tiers of income, that the base income is uses one tier, like the 30-35% or the equivalent post-tax, now that we're post-DCJA. And then there is often a different percentage for bonus, and then a different percentage again for executive compensation. And that means RSUs, stock options, and these kind of stuff, right? You don't see that, Mary?
Oh, definitely. And yeah, definitely restructure it, especially if somebody is an extremely high earner. So sometimes it will be income up to a certain point. And I remember we had a tier after $1 million in compensation and then after 1.5 million, and it goes down as the income increases, because there's the feeling like somebody really doesn't want to get penalized for working really extra hard and putting in those hours. So yeah, definitely. And there's also the question of need, right? As the income increases, the need is decreased. Mm-hmm. And that also is always a discussion, because what one person feels is sufficient is could be different from what another person feels. So it is a discussion to see what each person feels is fair.
Yeah, well, I just had a discussion last week, a five-way meeting, where I'm the mediator. And so we were with the two clients and their attorneys, and we were talking about just this exact thing, the two tiers, and assigning a percentage to one tier and then another percentage to the second tier. And one of the attorneys was very adamant that they rarely assign the same number for those tiers. So you do get conflicting information. You know, you do, you know, you hear different things. So you're going to get a different answer no matter who you ask about that question. And so that's why we always say, you know, don't always think what you hear from another case is going to be on your case. You know, you need to really focus on your situation and the situation, the process that you're in, you know, whether it's mediation or litigation. So I always warn people, you know, just because it worked out that way for them doesn't mean it's going to work that way for you, you know, because it's all a negotiation. These percentages are negotiations. You know, the first percentage is a negotiation because we have to now come up with a different percentage because 30 to 35 doesn't work. So we, you know, we've talked about this. We find the exact tax equivalent that equals that 30 to 35%. And if people out there don't understand, so just very easily, you have one person making 100,000, you have another party making 50,000. If you subtract those two incomes, you now have 50,000. And let's say we're going to use 35% just as a, you know, a starting point for alimony. You take that 55% to $50,000 and you times it by 35%. That would be an alimony number pre the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. So right. That's when we're talking about percentages. That's how we get there. We're taking the two gross incomes and timesing the difference by a percentage.
Right. So one of the things that is sort of interesting, right, is that alimony is just one of the income issues that happens in a divorce. Another one that often happens is child support. And so we've covered child support last fall, right? I'm losing track of time. There is a couple of different things in there. I think we had a little bit of a discussion beforehand and we didn't have full agreement, but are there differences between the way that income is handled for child support compared to alimony, or maybe vice versa?
Well, what's interesting, as we all noted, is that in the alimony law, there is no definition of income. So often what people do is they will look at the child support guidelines, which does provide a very, very comprehensive list of what income is. And people often will look at that, but you had mentioned that some attorneys will not include certain aspects in alimony that they will in child support. So again, it's a discussion.
Right. So one of the things that we had talked about before there was the concept of double dipping.
Yeah.
Right. Is that if a source of income was used for child support, that it wouldn't be used for alimony also.
And what's really nice is that this October, there were new child support guidelines that came out, and they actually clarified something which many of us had questions about. And that is, if somebody is receiving child support, then are they allowed to, for under $400,000, are they also able to receive alimony? And what the court said is that there are different cases. Either you could run child support first, and then what you do is you will include that child support number in the income for the person receiving child support when you do look at alimony. So if you do child support first, then you can run the alimony numbers with the child support income also. It's sort of different if you do alimony first, but it basically, the courts have said what's really helpful to do is just try out different scenarios, looking at child support only, looking at alimony or unallocated support, looking at both of them together. And Chris, we just did that in a case, and we looked at all the three different amounts that came, and then we looked at expenses, and we saw, okay, at the end of the day, what is that actual amount of money that people have after taxes, and then what can they afford? Can they afford this amount, this amount, this amount? So it really is, you know, looking at the numbers is just the beginning of the analysis, because then you also have to see how people are going to be living with the amount that they receive. But does somebody have a very big surplus and somebody have a deficit? If so, then you have to tweak the numbers a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's it's a difficult topic in the sense that it's very fuzzy and it's not exactly predetermined as people would prefer. Right?
Yeah. Well, but, Chris. I just always go back to what Fern Froland said. You know, I like this part, Chris. And she did both our first episode of the Child Support Guidelines and the first episode of Alimony. And she said, because she was one of the people on the task force for both of those policies, that they never meant for a spouse who is getting, you know, who needs the support to get the sloppy seconds of alimony. So she said that we never meant for a, you know, a stay-at-home mom, whoever, or a stay-at-home dad to get the sloppy seconds, which means that calculating alimony first is definitely something to look at. And, you know, because they never intended it to be that way, but it just happened to fall that way because it was easier to do it that way. Obviously now when the guidelines say, you know, we can do either way, it's going to be a little more involved. And maybe some people don't want to get involved with that, but that's where people like Chris and I come into play. Like I think you said, you were just working on a case together where Chris provided you those numbers. That is how you fairly and equitably try to figure out what is the best income or best support number for the family.
Right.
Looking at all that.
Yeah, these are difficult topics there. But so another question with respect to the child support part is that you were mentioning the child support guidelines that just came out this last October. And one other thing that came out there is that the income that is considered for child support in the case that we do child support first, was increased from $250,000 of joint income to $400,000 of joint income. So clearly there are tons of people in the area that have more than $400,000 in joint income, but they're still the minority. For most people, it seems that to increase it from 250 to 400 essentially eliminates the possibility of alimony when you do child support first.
So right? That's why it's so important to look and maybe then do unallocated support instead of alimony for that person. But I think what's essential is that the person who is home with the children is not receiving less than somebody would be who does not have any children, because that just does not make any sense.
Right. And so I think that really points to why we should work on doing the alimony first and then follow up with the child support. Mm-hmm. Right.
It also depends, Chris, too, on the age of the kids. You know, if you have kids that are closer to, you know, or in college, or they're going to be phasing out of child support anyway. So it might make more sense to have it all of an alimony payment. That isn't going to end in a year or two and then have to go back to court for a modification to transfer that child support to alimony. So there, you know, just depends on the case.
You do have to bear in mind that alimony could end if somebody's going to cohabit for 3 months. So mm-hmm. there are problems with alimony that could end very quickly. So then
that's what I'm saying. It's the kids are older, you know, so that the timelines are probably might be the same.
So it's all a lot of things to take into account.
Yeah. So we've talked there about income as if it is a determined thing. One of the things I come across also is the idea of attributed income. That is when you have the lower earner who doesn't make who's either very part-time or doesn't make any income, who has income attributed to them. So in the formula, we say we will run the formula as if he or she would make X dollars. To me, that seems to be a bit unfair, right? In the sense that if someone has stayed at home, because it's usually for someone who has stayed at home for many years, to assume that she can, because it's usually she, can make all of a sudden 70K or 80K doesn't make much, a lot of sense. Do you guys come across that also?
I think there was recently a case that basically said that it's very hard to attribute income, that you can't just say there are jobs out there. You have to really be a lot more specific, because there is a realization that it is difficult for somebody who's been out of the workforce for a very long time to be able to then get you somebody. Sometimes somebody will say, well, this person went to law school. This person could then have a starting salary of, you know, first years, but nobody's going to hire a 50-year-old woman, you know, as a first year. It just doesn't work that way. So there has to be a little bit of reality involved with that.
I think there was a TV show where it happened.
Everything happens on TV.
Well, I know in my own situation, I was a stay-at-home mom for 18 years. And when I no one said I had to go back to work, but I did, because I wanted to. I didn't want to be accused of sitting home eating bonbons and collecting alimony. So I did get a job and with a friend. I called a friend and said, hey, I want to get into financial planning. And he said, okay. So I went to work there 3 days a week. I was getting paid, you know, $16 an hour. So babysitters were making more than me. I had worked beforehand, you know, I went to college and everything, but this is the reality of someone who is home, taking care of kids, trying to get back out into the workforce. It's not easy. You know, and so attributing income it happens a lot in litigation, you know, but then you have to pay for people to go and do all these, you know, I forget, what do they call them? The people that do that, determine income. But, you know, in ADR, in mediation or collaborative, we tend to maybe deal with it differently. And then again, alimony is always modifiable. So if someone does get a job, the person paying alimony can always go and say, hey, you're making money now, you don't need as much alimony. Or in the agreement that I've seen too, is where they say the spouse can earn up to $60,000 and then there will be a modification of alimony.
Right. We do that. And also, just because people are divorced doesn't mean that the caring for the children is going to stop. And what is ironic, in a sense, is that the higher income that one spouse earns, then often that means that that person, well, it used to be before Corona, would be traveling all the time, or it could be if the person is a consultant or in another high power job where they're rarely home, which then means that most of the parenting will fall on the other person. So it really is unrealistic to say, okay, you now need a 40 hours a week job, because who's going to stay with a child if the child gets sick? You know, there are many times where school ends early because of teacher conferences or for any other reason. So there really is to have a realistic view of, okay, what exactly is expected. And also what I see is that I've seen in other cases where people are high earners and they've been traveling for years and they're getting older and they're saying, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm getting really tired. I just can't go to California or whatever every single week. It's exhausting. And then that's also a question, because is it something that they've talked about already before the divorce for years and this was something anticipated? Or is this somebody now thinking, well, maybe I'm going to earn less because I don't want to pay as much? So that's also a conversation. And sometimes you really have to delve into it to see the real motivations.
Is it something that happens naturally, right? I'm not in the same case as Diane, but the reason I'm in this line of work is because I got burned out from traveling. And I wanted an easy job, you know, one where I could sleep in my own bed every night.
Easy in that sense, yes. Easy in that
sense. Not easy any other way.
Not easy any other way. But I think what we're kind of the theme here is that, you know, everything's a case-by-case basis. And we're going to use those two words again. It depends. You know, when someone asks you something, is this income going to be used? Well, it depends. And how are you going to do this? Well, it depends, because that's what it is. We have our guidelines, but we just have to look at everything and see what works best for the parties, and you know, what is the need and what is the ability to pay, and those two things have to be taken into consideration. And then before you can even get to those, though, you have to agree on the income that you're going to use.
Right.
Very often they don't have that conversation, you know, up front. We need to, and that's like one of the first things I do is let's agree on what income to use.
One of the things that you brought up, Miriam, is that question of potentially decreasing income with age. I think it happens a lot. I mean, people will get out of their stressful jobs, not just because they're getting divorced. They will get out of their stressful jobs. It's unlikely for most people that they will keep working at the same rate up until Social Security tells them to retire, right? And I think that's a problem also, because when we discuss these things, right, we tend to discuss it as a point in time that will then extend indefinitely, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Right? It's well documented, for instance, that divorce does bring extra stress, and for instance, it creates additional car accidents. Right? It decreases performance at work, and therefore the possibility of getting laid off and everything else.
It happens a lot.
It does. It does happen.
Right. And these are not things that that are easy to factor in, which is one of the reasons why people should go through mediation, because it saves time, money.
Relationships and children.
Relationships and children. Because it saves all of that, right? That it allows people to get an agreement that works for both of them faster, so they can get on and move on with their lives.
And often what I find is it's transformative, because it also really helps with conversations and communication. And I often find that it really helps with the relationship, which is incredibly important to lower stress and incredibly important for the couple, but also most important for the children. If they have children, that the best outcome for children of divorce is if the parents are able to maintain a certain amount of amicability. So it's really, really helpful. And Robert Emery did studies on it and found that the benefits of mediation last for more than a decade. So it really is a very important, it doesn't always work for people, but it's always really helpful to try mediation first.
And it's an interesting concept that you brought up, Diane, where we've talked, we introduced this segment of the conversation with attribution of income. And I think what you described was sort of a reverse attribution, whereby the income that the lower earner might earn up to a certain limit would not be factored into calculations. I think that it happened to you also like that, right?
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Can you describe more?
Well, because here's the thing. So if you do go out and get a job, your kids are older, they're in college like mine, where they were, you know, a senior in high school and off in college. So I had the ability to go to work. But if every time someone goes to work, you're going to keep getting cut down on your alimony, how is this person ever going to excel or to move forward in life if they're just being kept at one level of income? Whereas the other party, their income keeps increasing. But if you're the one receiving the alimony, and then every time you have an income, it's going to reduce your alimony, you're going to be stuck. So I think providing it's also providing that person with the ability to say, okay, I can go out and earn more and I'm not going to be affected yet. So there's some incentive to go out and improve your situation. Whereas if your income's just going to keep getting cut down, you're never going to improve, you know, move up the scale. Why should I go out and work? So at least I'm given a little bit of a leeway. And then by the time you're at that place, you're like, oh, you know what? I'm in a much better place now. I don't even want alimony anymore. It's like, that's what happens, because now you've made it. You're on your own two feet. You've transitioned from divorce to a good life. and you know, you're on your way, and now you're, you know, you're able to provide for your own, you know, not all the time. It just, it takes time. It's not going to happen in a year or two. You know, I'm talking 5, 10 years, whatever, somewhere between there. But I think being able to have some leeway there psychologically is good. And I think it's the fair thing to do too.
And then it inures, as you mentioned, over time, it inures to the benefit of the payer anyway. So mm-hmm. It really is helpful, even though at first you might think that it isn't.
Right. So we had talked before at some of the introductory episodes about alternate kinds of alimony, like rehabilitative alimony. So to some extent, what you're talking about there is an application of the concept, if you will, that to give the lower earner enough runway so that they can, get on their own 2 feet over time. Mm-hmm.
So I think what we've seen is incentives in both directions. So incentives for the lower earner to earn more, and then incentives for the higher earner also to have the upper amounts of what that earner is earning, not used as much for alimony. So both people have the incentive to work and to earn as much as they can.
Right. Because, you know, if there's that argument that the income earned after the divorce, you know, if it's a much higher level than what was enjoyed during the marriage, there's a side that says, well, is the ex-spouse entitled to that higher income that wasn't a part of the marital lifestyle? So that's always another, argument that is there for both sides. And so I think that's, you know, limiting it and having it, sometimes there's limits, you know, alimony will only be calculated up to whatever the maximum was during the marriage. But again, it depends on the length of marriage. If this was a very long-term marriage, like 30 years, which I see a lot of people now, 30, I just have one at 45 years. It's not, I think that spouse is entitled to any future increases in income because their marriage was so long. And there's no way that this person's going to ever be able to earn anything like that. So I
although with a marriage of 45 years, there are not many earning years left.
Well, believe it or not, he's doing really well right now. So.
And also,
she's also older than him too. That's the problem too. She's older than him.
But there are also other times where we'll say somebody has been working a little bit and putting somebody through medical school, residency, internship, and then suddenly they're getting divorced right as the person is about to earn a higher income as a doctor. Now, is that fair to say, okay, I've been with you through all of the pain and all of the difficulty, and now you could go and ride off into the sunset? So it really, as we always said, it really depends on the circumstances, and there really has to be an element of fairness.
Yeah.
I think the point about besides fairness, which I think we all believe in, although fair is a four-letter word, so it's really hard to define and achieve. Something you mentioned earlier, Miriam, is about the questions of incentives. It seems that a lot of the time when people get into a divorce situation, they're not at their best. We know that, right? And it's completely understandable. But they're looking more to punish than to do anything else. And what you are talking about there is about potentially incenting them to do better for themselves, right? And do you come across these kind of stuff where people are okay with incentives, positive incentives?
And I think in general, I mean, especially if people have children, just to continue to let them know that, you know, they're helping the mother of their child or the father of their child, and they're helping so that it'll be better for the kids also. And that often is also helpful. And sometimes can be used if there's a question about certain income that somebody feels like, I really don't want to give this, then there are other creative ways that you could have maybe that person putting in that money into a college account, or maybe having that person put it into a bank account that's used for children's expenses. So there are ways to incentivize in other ways also, because the one common denominator that they do have is the bond. But one aspect of mediation is to try to really take them from the revenge part to the more collaboration and the more trying to show, yes, I'm a good person, and I'm going to be more generous, because that's going to help with the relationship, and it's going to, I think, eventually help them also feel better about themselves.
And unfortunately, that doesn't happen in litigation. And that's the sad part, you know, the revenge and the having to get back at somebody is rampant.
And how do we precisely apply that rule that isn't written? Right. So anyway, it's complicated. But in your the other question with respect to income is, I think, Diane, you brought it up, is that income changes over time. Mm-hmm. Right. And do you see a lot of people going through mediation, Miriam, who decides that they want to modify later on?
Yes. And in fact, a lot of mediation agreements have clauses where they will modify. They'll look at their income and they'll look at their income, and people get to decide whether it's every year, every 2 years, but there are, if there's an increase or decrease in their income by 10 or 15%. So they get to decide at what point would I think this is important to modify, and the agreement allows for them to modify. And what's wonderful now is that there's a joint petition. So you don't even have to go for an in-person hearing typically. What you do is if you both agree, then you just will sign something called a joint petition. You say you want to change the levels of the support. You give the reason, you update your financial statements, you send them in, and often the judge could rule on that without even a hearing. So it's very helpful. And yes, it definitely does. But clients have to remember to do that, because sometimes I ran into somebody who 10 years later was saying, oh, it's terrible. We had decided to do alimony back when it was deductible to the payer, but now I'm earning so much more money and I have to pay all of these taxes. And I'm like, remember, your agreement said that you would modify in this case, and they just never did. So Yep. We do have these modification provisions, but it's really important for people to remember them and to actually do it.
Right. And the other thing that I do a lot of times too, is I help provide the language to make it easier for the clients to do it. You know, if there's a formula, spell it out so that by way of example, and I literally have provided fill in the blanks so that they can print it out each year. And it says here, put this person's income here, put this person's, do this, do that. And that way going forward, it makes it easier. Because I still have a client who we did a collaborative agreement four or five years ago now. And my name is in the agreement to help them calculate alimony on an annual basis, because it is a self-modifying agreement. I finally made them a fill in the blank and they were able to do it, it was, hard for them to come to me each year. So I said, all right, you know what? You don't need me. They didn't need me. So I just did this easier for them to fill in the blank.
I think it's important. And I think it's really great that this can be done. Mm-hmm. And it usually can be done better in mediation or collaborative law cases. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way in litigation. And that would be one extra reason not to do litigation if you can, because going back to court to do a modification, it's going to cost you a bundle of money.
Even that, Chris, they'll say parties are, to exchange tax returns or, W-2s or pay stubs on an annual basis in litigation. How many cases do you know where that one party never provides the information? And they, even after they, they're taken to court for contempt, they still won't provide the information. And they just, because it's a control issue, and they just keep going on and on and on and on and on. It's just, it drives me crazy.
This is sort of an interesting point that has bugged me for a while. Do you put in the enforcement mechanisms?
I mean, we always have in ours, if they don't agree, they go back to mediation.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. I think there is only so much you can do with that, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, the court doesn't have time to hear a lot of these things and the contempt charges. And, just if the judge could just say, look, would you give them your pay stub and your W-2, please, and get out of here? That's what,
I was a judge, what I would do. The courts are totally swamped. So if you want to file a contempt petition, it's going to take a while.
Yep. Anyway,
just to be heard.
Yep. And you had to pay your attorney the money to just sit there and wait for it. And it's, sometimes I get those cases and I'm just like, ugh.
So I know you're a mediator, Miriam, but how do you find the litigators address these kind of issues?
It depends. It really, you know, there are the collaborative law litigators in a sense, who, I mean, occasionally you'll have some who are basically, you know, I had one who was insisting that if the higher earner increased salary, that wouldn't be included. You couldn't recalculate. But if the higher earner decreased salary, then you would have to recalculate. And we're just sitting there thinking, okay, that sort of doesn't work. You know, that's not fair. And was totally, totally arguing this as if it was something that is normally done. And so it really depends. And what I always remind the people with whom I work is you're the ones who have to go home at night and sleep with whatever the agreement is. And that's really important that you know yourselves, you know your situation much better than somebody else. And you have to always think about it. Is this person really working for your best interests or not? And you have to think, and often attorneys are, but sometimes they're not. And you know, that having clauses that you have to run into court every second if there's a disagreement is really helpful for the attorney, but it's really not helpful for the clients. So no. We try to keep the clients away from court as much as possible.
Yep, agreed. Because as you know, Chris, you really don't want a state employee, that's the judge, deciding your life and your outcome. You don't.
And why not?
Because like Miriam just said, they don't know your situation. You know it better. Right. You know what's going to work and what's not going
to
work.
I think we've used that phrase a bit about not wanting a state employee to determine your life. And they're sort of dismissive because the judges, you know, they are humans too, but they are really busy people. Mm-hmm. Right. And when a couple gets in front of them to get divorced, they normally get no more than 10 minutes, right? So,
yep.
In 10 minutes, the state employee is supposed to make a decision that is fair and equitable.
Exactly.
And not for the rest of their lives. And basically, it doesn't work very well.
No, it doesn't. Not at all.
going back to income a little bit, should we talk about stock options that, because, you know, now there was also a case about stock options that certain stock options that have vested are split as property. But then there are unvested stock options and what happens there. And there's a formula called the Bacanti formula, which you do, which will say that certain options could be considered marital assets and certain aren't. But what's important to understand is that the assets that are not considered marital assets that the person who has the stock options gets, that income from those options is counted as alimony, as income for either alimony or child support. And that's really important.
Right. Well, it's important too, in that it's the grants that are earned after the mort, after the date of divorce. So any grants that are earned during the marriage, you know, the vested and unvested are considered marital assets. How you deal with them is another thing, but it's any future grants. Those can be considered, whether it's when it vests as an RSU, it's going to show up on a W-2. That income, you know, can be used as a source, or that income. And then as well, when they go to sell that stock in the future, any capital gains on those sales can also be used as a source of income. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So you got to keep track of that. That's a really hard thing to do, is keeping track of all that.
It is. I mean, the reality is that you have, it works best in the cases of public companies, because there is a definite value to that, to those RSUs and stock options. And what happens is that many employees will get these grants on a regular basis. I mean, often on a quarterly basis. And so if you get it on a quarterly basis, clearly it's part of your income package. Mm-hmm. Right? But it's much harder to deal with when these are private companies, like a startup, because you can't tell what the value of that thing is.
So that's also one of those if, as, and whens, because especially for startup, it's not really in the middle. It's either it's worth very little, if nothing, or it's worth a lot because the company's big. Like I know somebody who was a lawyer for a startup years and years ago, and he ended up getting shares because they couldn't afford to pay him, and the startup's name was Pepsi Cola. So quite well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, it happens relatively often. I mean, there is a spinoff of IBM, I forget the exact name, in the past couple of years, where it seems that a few of the senior execs there are not taking any direct compensation, meaning any dollar compensation, all they're getting is shares. Options. Okay. And that's for a public company, which is sort of really interesting, right? Yeah.
So another way that those that options can be handled, though, so that you don't always have to keep track of them, is you can, you know, offset them. So you can say, all right, any future grants will not be used as income, but on the flip side, this person's going to receive more in the sale of the proceeds from the home or something. So, I mean, you know, we don't, there are cases, especially in mediation and collaborative, where you can try, because the goal is to try to separate people as much as possible. And, you know, if you're in your 40s and you're getting, it's going to be a long time that they have to keep track of these future grants. So let's try to sever the ties and see if we can't offset it somewhere, you know, or say future grants are going to be used for college. Like I think you said, Miriam, you know, I think that's a good way to use them as well.
I just had an agreement where it's basically you get the stock options, I get the house, and they work with it. And that way they have no children, so they really wanted to be able to go their separate ways and not
exactly.
Have
to.
I was going to my next question, really, which is all of this is really complicated. How do we simplify it? And you just brought it up. You said, okay, I keep the house, you keep the option, or something like this, right?
Yep. Yep.
And it really depends. You know, there are some people who are numbers people, both of them, and they are into, let's, you know, determine this and that, and they could do it. And then there are other people who don't, or if you have one person who's a financial person and the other person who isn't, then you also might want to make it more simple, because the person who has no clue about the finances and just doesn't have the brain for it is not going to be able to stay on track and say, oh yeah, I know that this stock is going to be vesting in another 3 years. I mean, it's doubtful that they're going to really be on top of things. So you want to make sure that they could get their income as easily as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had an attorney once, or he used to say all the time, you know, once you get that signed agreement, you can stick it in a drawer. And I'm like, no, you can't. Don't stick that agreement in the drawer. Oh my gosh, if you have things like, you know, future, all this other stuff that needs to be worked out, do not stick that separation agreement in the drawer.
So I know that there are several people out there that I know personally who actually haven't even read their divorce agreement because it is painful, right? Yeah. So I get the point, right? And so I have examples of one person in particular who calls me and tells me, so when does alimony end?
I agree. I think this is a time period in their lives that they don't, it's a stressful time, and you just sort of want to put it psychologically, figuratively, and literally in that drawer and not worry about it. But as you were saying, Diane, it really is important to look at it and to keep a note of what you need to look back on and check, especially if you have recalculation provisions.
Yeah, definitely. Because I have some of those cases right now, and they're, you know, post-divorce. And it's just, I always say, what does your agreement say? We need to go back to your agreement. And they're like, oh.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah. There is a case that Diane and I have sort of bounced back and forth where that was exactly the problem. He said, so what does the agreement say again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had one where calculating income was done said differently in two different provisions. So somebody called for a post-divorce case and said, I don't understand it. And they looked, I said, I don't understand it either. Like, it makes sense. It you know, each provision is going against the other provision. So
yep. That's not good either. Yeah. No, well, it looks like we are at the top of the hour almost.
It looks like we've killed the topic. I think we, I think if we were to go into sub segments of that, I think we could go into a greater level of detail, especially I think on the topics of executive comp, but we'll leave that for another time.
Well, these are great. I think I'm going to go back and listen to some of your older ones.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Miriam. It's been really great. And I mean, maybe we can do more of that at another time on a different topic.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Good. All right, everybody. Well, TGIDF, and we will see you next Friday.
Actually, we see you on the 29th.
Not next Friday.
Right. No, because we discovered, thanks to Miriam, actually, that we have holidays in between. Okay, so we'll see you on the 29th, and I forget exactly what we're talking about on the 29th. It is actually business income.
Right, business income.
And so in the meantime, enjoy the holidays next week. I think there is a spring break for the kids, if you have kids. And if you don't have kids, take the spring break anyway.